Side 11, Eon, by Greg Baer. Continuing on page 428. In that time, I learned that the engineer had sought to repay his people for the injury he had done to them, however inadvertently. After the Jot Wars, the Geshel-ruled Hexamon decided it was unnecessary to proceed to Epsilon Eridani. The Thistledown's course was uncertain, and to be truthful, they simply thought there was more potential for settlement and exploration in the way. They were right, but that did not satisfy the Orthodox Naderites. They had lost not only their mission in life, but their Earth and their home universe. So before retiring his corpus, Kuzhinovsky secretly reprogrammed the Thistledown guidance systems. The ship sought out and located the home solar system and began a return journey. "I don't see how I can help," Patricia said. "Kuzhinovsky's partials, when assembled, almost equal the original," Sir Oyu said. "We lack only the final impressed shape, the mystery, to have him back with us. In this way, we hope to repay him for what he gave us. We hope to let him see his success." Patricia glanced at Olney, to Oyu, and then to Yates. "And what will you give us?" she asked. "Your colleagues will have their choice of returning to Earth or proceeding down the way with the Geshels. You, on the other hand, will be given the means to play out your dream."
"My dream?"
Rai Oryu walked to a smooth black cabinet under the center of the shimmering cupola. He opened the cabinet and brought out a small pearl-white box. Returning, he held the box to Patricia and instructed her to open it. She lifted the lid. Within, lying in a hollow of green velvet, was a miniature version of the clavicle that depended from the scaffold. Yates looked upon it with her and sighed. "We're offering you an exchange, a trade in which you lose nothing," Rai Oryu said. "You let us copy your mystery to complete the engineer's personality record, and we will let you search for your home."
"You're saying that my soul and Kuzhinovsky's are identical?" Patricia asked.
"Soul is an imprecise term," the gate opener said. "Mystery at least has the advantage of a more precise application. When everything in a personality, memory, thought patterns, skills, has been abstracted out, the sum of their parts is still not the whole. There is a super pattern which colors the entire psyche and which can be lost when even the great majority of fragments are reassembled. This is called the mystery. We have never been able to synthesize it. It is ineffable, and it can only be transferred by an imposition of all the patterns of one person on the assembled personality fragments of another. What is already present in the other is rejected. What is not present, the mystery, is retained. That is the gift you could give to us, to Kuzhinovsky." She took hold of Vanir's hand, suddenly afraid. This was not in the same league with the things that had gone before. It seemed abruptly mystical and unconvincing. For a time, she had thought that nothing could remain unknown to these descendants, and yet here it was, primary and basic, elaborated upon, manipulated, but not solved.
"You could take it from me by force," she said. "Why try to convince me?"
"Force is not useful in these circumstances," Rai Oryu said. "Either you give voluntarily, or you do not give at all."
"Why do you want him back? Hasn't he served his purpose?"
"It's a matter of honor," Olmi smiled. "If the Knights of the Round Table could have brought King Arthur back, don't you think they would have? The engineer must see that his plan has come to fruition."
"But not as he expected."
"No," Olmi admitted. Patricia looked down at her clasped hands.
"Do I lose anything?"
"No," the gate opener said patiently.
"And in exchange, I get to use this."
She pointed to the miniature clavicle.
"Why is it so small?"
"It has been deactivated," Yates said.
"It's yours," he nodded.
"Yates will transfer its power to you, and you will learn how to use it during the ceremony," Rai Oryu said. "You will stand by my side."
"Is Kuzhinovsky here? I mean, his fragments?" He is within me, Olme said, pointing to his head.
Patricia looked at Lanier, her expression that of a little girl, uncertain whether she was being told wonderful lies or incredible truths. She shifted her gaze to Olme.
He's in your implant?
Olme nodded. I carry additional implants in my body, sufficient to contain him.
Something big is going on in your city, isn't it? Patricia asked.
Very big. Your companions back on the Thistledown should know more about it by now.
That's why the president couldn't stay with us.
Yes. We have to rest, Lanier interrupted. We haven't slept or eaten for hours.
You're going to push the Axis city into orbit around the Earth, destroy Thistledown?
Not precisely, Ryoryu said. But enough for now. Mr. Lanier is right. After you've rested, we'll resume. Talk shop, I believe you call it. Patricia narrowed her eyes and shook her head slowly.
I don't know what you people would want to talk with me about. I have to be a complete amateur, a primitive compared with you.
If we haven't convinced you of your value and your influence, then we are not being sufficiently clear, Olme said. You are the source of Kozhinovsky's work on the way. You laid the theoretical foundations. That is why we believe you can share the mystery with him. He was your greatest student. You were the teacher, Patricia.
Mirsky hunted through the crowd of Russians for Pogodin, Anyankovsky, or Garabedian, keeping an eye on the crosses passing overhead. The soldiers that had once been under his command eyed him sullenly, moving out of his path with fated indifference. He lifted up on his toes, trying to scan the sea of heads, and spotted Pletnyov's red face and fuzzy, short-cut crown of hair. Maneuvering in that direction, he came up behind the former heavy lifter commander and laid a hand on his shoulder. Pletnyov turned quickly and brushed the hand away, then cocked his head to one side on seeing Mirsky.
Where are the others? Mirsky asked.
Who?
The other assassins? You left us with a hellish mess, Comrade General. Pletnyov's voice was thick, his words mushy, frightened and angry at once.
Pogodin, Garabedian, Anyankovsky, Mirsky prompted.
I haven't seen them since this...
Whatever it is, Pletnyov said.
Now leave me alone.
You were with them, Mirsky persisted. What happened?
What do you mean, what happened?
To Vilgorsky and the other political officers.
Pletnyov surveyed the sky suspiciously, looking for crosses.
They're dead, Comrade General. I wasn't there, but Garabedian told me. They were shot.
He turned away from Mirsky, murmuring, I hope to God these hounds of heaven don't know.
More crosses flew overhead, causing heads to turn like a sea of wheat in a wind. Mirsky walked away, hands in pockets, bumping shoulders and plowing his way through the men, face creased in concentration.
This must have been what it was like for the stoners when the last holdouts were evacuated, Hoffman thought. Shuttle after shuttle of blunt-nosed craft flying back and forth to the borehole, and the huge tube writer Berenson said was waiting there, loading in groups of 20 from each chamber. She was glad Wallace and Polk were in her group. She had grown to rely on them. Anne was not. She was apparently still in the first chamber, or aboard already. The woman in black, left behind by Santiago, tended her group of 400 with all the mastery of a shepherd over a flock. Her dogs were the chromium crosses, which gently and insistently brooked no dissent, at least not dissent in terms of wandering away. Hoffman wondered vaguely if mood-altering devices were being used on them. She felt calm, not at all apprehensive, and clear-headed, even rested, better in fact than she had felt in weeks. About half in her group were Russians. By a kind of mutual consent, the Russians divided from the Americans, though the craft had brought them in mixed. Mirsky, as far as she saw, was not among them, nor were the officers who had taken command in his place. Hoffman's time came. The woman asked them to step forward, pointing to each in turn, until 20 had been separated from the larger group. The blunt arrowhead craft had landed as they were being chosen. She took a deep breath when her turn came. In a way, this was a relief. All responsibility was gone now. This was a schism with all that had happened before. She found it surprisingly easy to let go. Sheep-like, she boarded the craft with the others. Chapter 61. Patricia and Lanier were given their privacy in a small cubicle at the south end of the terminal to sleep and have time for Patricia to think. A pictor provided some semblance of familiar surroundings, using the same basic decor as Patricia's quarters in the Axis City, but Lanier was scarcely comforted. He was angry and confused. "You don't have any idea what they're talking about," he told her as they sat on opposite ends of the couch. "For all we know, they're out to steal your soul. And I don't care what they say, it does sound suspiciously like that, doesn't it?" Patricia stared steadily at the Illusart window opposite, with its view of pine trees and bright blue sky beyond. "I suppose they could do that if they wanted," she said. "Damned right they could. We don't know anything about them. They've manipulated our view of them ever since we arrived. They've tried to educate us. We know a lot more than we did then. What Olmi and Ramkikura have been saying makes sense." Lanier shook his head vigorously. He was having none of that. Anger was a slow, smoking coal inside, and he could not damp it. "They aren't really giving you a choice." "Yes, they are," Patricia insisted. "They won't take anything from me. I won't volunteer."
"Bullshit!" Lanier exploded.
He stood and felt wildly for the boundaries of the cubicle, which he knew was no more than 3 meters on a side. He could not feel them. The illusion was complete, even to the distance between them, as he walked across the room. "Everything's a sham here. For all we know, nothing we've seen is real since we arrived. That would make sense. Why show us more than they have to?"
"They're not..."
She tried to find the right word.
"Not bad people."
"You accept that crap about your being the teacher, the precursor?"
"Why not?"
Patricia turned to him and held out her hand. He walked back to the couch and took it.
"I've seen some of the papers I will write."
She scrunched her eyes shut and shook her head, putting her other hand to her cheek.
"I probably will never write them, but someone else who is me will, or has written them. And they really do point to all this. It's what's been in my head, unformed, for years now. I've known for almost as long that I was the only one in our time, our world, thinking seriously about such things. So, ego aside, I don't disbelieve that."
She smiled up at him.
"Judith Hoffman thought I was the only one. You accepted that."
"You love being a cultural hero. Is that it?"
Coming down on her too hard, he thought. "Ease up. And why are you angry?"
"No,"
she said softly.
"I don't care, actually. There's not much I do care about now."
Lanier let go of her hand and backed around the table, rubbing his chin, glancing at her repeatedly from the corners of his eyes. "You just want to go home." She nodded. "You can't go home again."
"I can."
"How?"
"You know the basics, Gary."
"I want specifics. How can you find your home?"
"If they teach me how to use a clavicle, I'll return to the blank section of the corridor we passed through, and I'll search through a geometry stack. For them, geometry stacks have been garbage areas, useless or worse than useless, but that's where I'll find a way home."
"Not very detailed plans, Patricia."
"They'll teach me," she said,
regarding him with her large black eyes. Not square at all now, not feline, but round and calm. "And what will they take?"
"Nothing."
She leaned her head back on the couch.
"They'll copy, not take."
"How can you trust them?" She didn't answer. "You really didn't need time to think, did you?"
"No,"
she admitted.
"Christ."
She stood and hugged him firmly, touching her cheek to his shoulder.
"I don't know what we are to each other, but I have to thank you."
He cradled her head with one hand and stared away at the juncture of wall and ceiling, blinking, lips drawn down at the corners. I don't know either.
I was beginning to think I wasn't human.
You... He didn't finish.
What I've been thinking, in some ways, that makes me more like them than like you. Do you understand that?
No.
I suppose it also makes my mystery appropriate for Kozhinovsky. He thought similar thoughts, and he had similar goals. He wanted to take his people home.
Lanier shook his head, rejecting everything.
They're not going to hurt me. They're going to teach me. I have to say yes.
They're blackmailing you. She raised her head suddenly, frowning.
They aren't, she said abstractedly. No more than I'm blackmailing them. Gary, I just thought of something, and why didn't I think of it before? Why are they opening another gate?
I don't know, Lanier said quickly. Her question seemed completely irrelevant.
I'll ask them.
He laughed. You're serious, aren't you?
That's why we were brought here, to witness the ceremony. Well, that's obviously not the main reason, but it was part of the package.
He thought for a moment, still holding her. Despite everything, despite his doubts and fears and suspicions, he had to admit that was something he would like to see.
I think we should sleep, Patricia said.
It was not incidental that they made love, but Lanier realized the act was not necessary to Patricia. She was in sight of her goal. Everything else, like the decor and the very bed they lay on, was window dressing. That made him feel insignificant, and it made him wonder what Patricia had become since her arrival on the stone.
Am I human?
She asked as they lay together. Probably, he said, trying to keep his voice steady and not completely succeeding. By the time Van Hamfuis's flawship arrived at the position formerly occupied by the Axis city, all gates up and down the way had been closed, and the lanes between them cleared. The situation was unprecedented in the history of the way. The Axis city had moved on. Under Corp Rep Rosengardner's direction, the city's flaw power stations had been seized from the last holdouts. Those who had been killed had had their implants carefully retrieved, some 183 citizens so far. The toll disturbed Gardner, but their deaths were not permanent. With the flaw shaft under his control, he had accelerated the Axis city, moving south toward the Thistledown. The journey had taken 16 hours. Van Hamfuis's flaw ship had followed, but there was little the president could do. In the Thistledown's sixth chamber, four members of Gardner's Kozhinovsky faction had committed the ultimate crime. They had tampered with the way machinery. The tampering was minor, but the penalty for even minor offenses was discorporation and complete wiping of all personality records. At this point, Gardner knew, there was no turning back. The flaw did not need to extend beyond the actual northern boundary of the seventh chamber. Its present extension, near the chamber's borehole, had been purely for convenience during the final stages of the Thistledown's evacuation and the construction of the Axis city. The machinery was now adjusted to reduce the flaw's length by 20 kilometers. Four teams of three citizens apiece then exited to the exterior of the asteroid, riding elevator shafts undiscovered by the recently arrived visitors. These shafts opened directly onto buried Beckman drive units. Using these drives, the rotation of the asteroid was slowed and then reduced to zero. The result at first was fairly minor in all chambers but the fourth, where wave action in the broad expanses of water forced huge globules into the air. There wasn't time to damp the effects. Gardner was working on a tight schedule. Radical Geschels and the moderates who had never actually committed themselves were given the opportunity to join Gardner's factioners. For many, there was no choice. Gardner's plans had little room for radical neomorphs. Populations were shuffled between the various precincts as quickly as possible, and city memory was rearranged and sectioned, all in preparation for the next step of Gardner's plan. The Axis city was partially unstrung from the flaw, the section containing Axis Nadir and Central City first. It was Gardner's plan to reverse the city, leaving these precincts for the Geschels who wished to travel down the way at near-light speed and force out the Jarts. What he needed to complete his plans were the two rotating cylinders of axes Thoreau and Euclid. The retuning of the gravity gradient between the Thistledown and the Way was extraordinarily delicate. The engineers within the sixth chamber had their hands full, especially when the large mass of Central City and Axis Nadir was shunted to one side within the seventh chamber, allowing the remaining precincts to be unstrung. The entire procedure took 5 hours. By the time it was done, Axis Nadir and Central City had reversed position on the floor with Axes Thoreau and Euclid. The two pairs of precincts and their related structures were separated by a kilometer, and the pair reserved for the Geshels, Central City and Axis Nadir, moved slowly north along the floor. The visitors had been informed of their choice. Of the roughly 2,000 captives, only 4 decided not to cast their lot with the group planning a return to Earth. Among them were Joseph Rimskaya and Beryl Wallace. The other 2 were Russians, Corporal Rodzinski and Lieutenant General Pavel Mirsky. The asteroid was then set into rotation again. Within all the chambers, some damage was unavoidable, but in the fourth chamber, the results were catastrophic. The water globules slowly broke over the basins and land, billions of gallons snapping trees, scouring the forests, and forming new rivers as the centrifugal force returned. The plasma tubes within all chambers were suddenly extinguished. The atmosphere barrier fields remained in force, but the chambers were plunged into abyssal night for the first time in 12 centuries. And in the seventh chamber, at the boundary of the Way and the end of the chamber itself, mechanical workers began setting powerful charges to blast the northern end from the asteroid and cauterize the Way. There was little the president or his followers could do. Gardner's organization was masterful, and the dedication of his followers complete. Once again, human history proved that the worst mistake possible in politics was underestimating one's opponents. Then Hemphuis had no choice but to accept Gardner's offer of a settlement and take control of the precincts allotted to the radical Geshels. Within Central City's walled, weightless, assigned to a neomorph Geshel guardian, Pavel Mirsky began to regret his decision. He seemed lost in a Bossian nightmare, and he asked himself if the urge for exploration and new things was worth the strangeness and anxiety. There were always some disadvantages to completely abandoning one's past and culture, and Mirsky had committed himself to what amounted to the grandest defection of all time. Chapter 62. Olmi stood alone by the scaffold, staring at the clavicle. He wished the engineer could interact with his thoughts, comment on his actions, either positively or otherwise, but Kochanowski was stored inactively. Vasquez and Lanier were still in their cubicle. For Olmi, the notion of sleeping for 8 hours at a time was at once peculiar and attractive. To have a long blank period in one's life, every day, to have that time free of thinking and immersed in a kind of other-world nothingness. Tacit cleansing was much more effective, but he was amused to find a primitive part of himself still longing for simple sleep. He had never given deep consideration to the differences between humans of his time and theirs, except insofar as he had to plan for their needs. Even with all the accoutrements and additions and manipulations of his time, the similarities far outweighed the differences. Yeats crossed the smooth green carpet of lawn to the scaffold. His face was grim. "Our time is limited," he dictated to Olmi. "The defense station at 1.9X9 says it's detecting excessive floor radiation. The Jarts could be preparing to open a new, very large gate." "Gate to a star's heart?" Olmi asked. "That's the supposition. Station personnel are preparing to pull back." The idea had been discussed in upper-level defense circles for decades. It was simple, if drastic. The Way at many points touched on stellar bodies. Since the Way was essentially a hollow, evacuated tube, opening a circuit of massive gates into the heart of a star would suck up the high-pressure, superheated plasma and distribute it throughout the Way. Barriers, though constructed of modified Way space-time, would transmit the extreme heat and finally break down, becoming level with the walls. The Way itself would remain intact, but everything else for billions of kilometers would simply dissolve to component particles in the fury. "How fast would the plasma front travel?" Olmi asked. "It would only be slowed by turbulence effects.
Its final velocity could be about 6,000 kilometers per second. Then we'd have about 32 hours to evacuate, if they can't open a gate remotely. The thought of the Jarts being able to manipulate way gates from a distance had sobered defense planners for years. The Jarts had never demonstrated such a capability within the human-controlled sector, but data from way disturbances had led many gate researchers, including Rai Oyu's team, to believe they were doing so beyond 2X9. "I passed word on to Senator Oyu," Yates continued. "Her father is with his researchers now. She'll tell him when he's available." Olney saw Patricia and Lanier emerge from the cubicle in the living quarters on the north side of the terminal shell. "Will Sir Vasquez agree, do you think?" Yates asked. "You've spent much more time with our guests than I." Olney picked at a symbol of uncertainty, carrying implications of resigned humor, an incomplete neomorph choosing between two high-fashion body designs. "I wish I had your calm," Yates said. "I could use a Talcet session right now." Patricia spotted Olney and Yates and waved at them, then touched Lanier's shoulder. Both crossed the grass toward the scaffold. "I have to see Sir Oyu," she told Olney. Lanier seemed haggard, his eyes darting back and forth. "He's in conference with his researchers. Senator Oyu will relay any message," Yates told her.
"Well, I suppose I don't have to tell him in particular. Olney..."
Lanier focused on Olney, his expression unhappy and resentful.
"I've decided I'll make the bargain."
Olney smiled.
"When would be convenient?" he asked.
"Our time is limited," Yates said. Patricia shrugged.
"I suppose now is fine. Any time."
"I'll hold you personally responsible," Lanier said to Olney, emphatically jabbing his finger at him.
"I take the responsibility," Olney said solemnly. "She will be protected."
Yates went to inform Senator Oyu that they were about to begin. Olney led them to the unfinished cupola where they had first met Rai Oyu and pictured instructions to a monitor floating nearby. "It will summon a medical worker. I'll make a few modifications in the worker and transfer the partials. You will then offer your mystery and the patterns will be conformed. It's quite simple."
"If it works, it's a goddamned miracle," Lanier said under his breath. "And you say it's simple."
"Lazarus come forth from your perspective, correct?"
Olney asked, hoping to amuse him.
"Don't patronize us," Lanier said. The man's anger was obviously building.
Olney thought he could understand why. Now that Patricia had made her decision, Lanier was cut out of the process. He was simply an appendage. Patricia had obviously ignored his misgivings. The medical worker, an upright, elongated, egg-shaped device about a meter tall, delineated with purple to show where manipulators and other instruments would emerge, approached them, floating a few centimeters above the grass. Olney pictured modifying instructions, and the worker extended a small cup shape at the end of a thick metallic gray cable. He placed the cup below his ear and closed his eyes. Patricia watched, eyes wide, crossing and uncrossing the fingers of both hands. Her calmness seemed artificial now. Lanier's stomach knotted. Patient Oyu and her father joined them just as Olney removed the cup. They said nothing, standing a few meters away to watch. The medical worker moved closer to Patricia. Attraction field spread out into a kind of cot before it, and Olney asked her to lie down. She complied. The worker then spread a fan of black cables around her head like a hairnet. The net adjusted itself, squeezing her hair. Patricia reached up to feel it.
"I should never go out in public with this thing on," she joked.
Lanier knelt beside the cot and took her hand. "Just a couple of Hottentots," he said, blowing in the wind. Patricia made a face, then rolled her head to look at Olney.
"I'm ready," she said. "There's no pain, no sensation whatsoever," Olney said. "Well, whatever, I'm ready."
She pressed Lanier's hand and released it. He stepped back. The net tightened, and she winced at the pressure. Not painful, but strong nevertheless. Lanier winced in sympathy, but did not move. Patient Oyu walked to his side and placed a hand on his shoulder.
"She carries a part of our dream," the senator said. "Do not worry."
Lanier squinted at her.
Patricia seemed to be concentrating, her eyes barely closed. Lanier felt a sick kind of fascination. There was no sound, nothing overt whatsoever, simply the transfer of whatever they were borrowing from her, copying. She opened her eyes and turned her head toward him. Lynette withdrew.
"I'm okay," she said, sitting up on the field. "I don't feel any different."
"The combination will take a few hours to mature," Olmi said. "Then Kozhinovsky should be with us again."
"Will he have a body?" Lanier asked.
Patricia stood by him.
"He'll occupy the worker until one can be made," Olmi said. "He can project an image of himself, however. That would be one sign of his complete reconstruction."
Patricia took Lanier's hand in hers again and squeezed it firmly.
"Thank you," she said.
"Thanks for what, for Christ's sake?"
"For being brave," she said.
Lanier stared at her in complete amazement. Patricia, Lanier, and Olmi followed the medical worker to the quarters where they had spent the night. Olmi judged it would be best if Kozhinovsky's first perceptions were in reasonably familiar surroundings, a normal room sparsely decorated and without too many people, or non-humans. Rye Oryu and Yates agreed. "Besides," the gate opener said, "you've been waiting for this moment for 5 centuries. It's your moment, much more than ours." In the quarters, they waited for 15 minutes before Olmi prompted the worker to display an image showing the progress of the personality it contained. Patricia raised her hand to her mouth as the image manifested before them. The image was grossly distorted, one half of the body large and bulbous, the other small, almost to vanishing. Its apparent solidity was imperfect, with some parts opaque and others transparent. Its color was predominantly blue. The elongated, side-slipping head seemed to watch them, turning from face to face. "Don't be disturbed," Olmi warned them. "The awareness of body shape is the last thing to mature." Across a period of minutes, almost imperceptibly, the distortions corrected themselves. The overall blue color became more natural, and the patches of translucency filled in. When the adjustments were completed, Kozhinovsky's image was fully and accurately formed, Olmi noted with satisfaction. It matched the appearance the engineer had once chosen for the official portrait miniatures, a slender, dark-haired man of medium height, with a sharp, long nose and inquisitive, humored black eyes, his skin colored like coffee. Olmi still searched for deviations. The mystery imposed upon the partials, however close to Kozhinovsky's original, was not exact. However, it was sufficient to return Kozhinovsky to full awareness, and that awareness would be patterned by the virtually complete memories of the partials to reproduce closely the personality that had been erased, assassinated, before Olmi was born. "Welcome," Olmi said aloud. The image regarded him steadily, then attempted to speak. Its lips moved, but produced no sound. The image wavered abruptly, and when it was solid again, said, "I know you. I feel much better. Very different. Have I been reconstructed?" "As best we can manage," Olmi said. "I remember so little, like bad dreams. You were a child when we first met." Olmi felt the rise of another emotion that Ram Kikura might have regarded as atavistic. "A boy, 5 years old, he said. He clearly remembered first seeing the engineer's partials in the apartment memory, remembered his child self frightened and fascinated at meeting someone famous and dead. How long have I been incomplete, dead, whatever I was?" 5 centuries, Olmi said. The engineer's expletive would have been extremely crude in his day. For Olmi now it was archaic and quaint. "Why was I brought back? Surely everyone was better off without me."
"Oh no," Olmi said sincerely. "We are honored to bring you back."
"I must be completely out of date."
"We can correct that in a few hours."
"I don't feel finished. Why is that?"
"You have to mature. Your reconstruction is still finding its pathways. You don't have your own body. You're occupying a medical worker."
Again the expletive, even stronger. I am behind the times. Only a mental midget could have fit into the most advanced worker. The image tilted its head forward, regarding only from beneath its brows, eyes questioning. I was damaged, wasn't I? Yes, Olme said. What's missing? The mystery. We had to work from partials only. Whose mystery replaced it? Olme pointed to Patricia. Thank you, Kotanowski said after a moment of thoughtful silence.
You're welcome,
Patricia said lamely.
You look familiar. I've seen you before.
This is Patricia Luisa Vasquez, Olme said. Kotanowski's expression was at first incredulous. The image extended its hand to Patricia. Patricia grabbed the hand, no longer surprised by the solidity and warmth of projections. The Patricia Luisa Vasquez?
One and only, Patricia replied.
Kotanowski's image leaned its head back, grimacing. I have an awful lot to catch up on. He released her hand, apologizing under his breath. He took Lanier's outstretched hand and shook it more briefly, his grip firm but not insistent. Lanier was more than a little awed to meet the man who had designed the corridor. I have a small, I don't know what it is, statue, hologram, whatever, of you. Back in my desk. You've been a puzzle to me for years. He realized he was babbling. We're from Earth, he concluded abruptly. Kuzhinovsky's face was unreadable. Where are we? He asked.
In the way, at 1.3x9, Olme replied.
Where is the Thistledown?
In orbit around the Earth and Moon.
What year?
2005, Patricia said.
That's journey year? Kuzhinovsky asked hopefully.
Anno Domini, Olme said.
The engineer suddenly looked very tired. How long before you can educate me?
We can start now, even before your personality is mature. Is that what you wish?
I think we'd better, don't you? Turning to Patricia again, he said, You're very young. How much work have you done? How many of your papers?
None of my most important ones, she replied.
This is not something I anticipated. It is not an obvious result of our work. I mean to say, how could I have missed it? And you must tell me how you got here, and why you. Even before Olme could arrange for the update of information, Patricia and the engineer were deeper in discussion. Within 4 hours, the researchers, representing 7 of the species that utilized the corridor, had gathered around the scaffold. Each of these species had demonstrated its usefulness to the human patrons, though by no means their subservience. They were full partners in the venture of the way, and they came in a wide variety of forms, though not necessarily much wider a variety than the neomorphs of the Axis city, Lanier thought. There were 3 Frants, cloaked in the shiny foil jackets that seemed to be their usual clothing away from Timbal. A being shaped like 2 upside-down U's connected with a thick, gnarled rope of flesh, lacking visible eyes, its skin as smooth and featureless as black glass, stood unmoving on its 4 elephantine feet a few meters from the front, surrounded by a red line of quarantine. It apparently did not find the atmosphere uncomfortable, however. A Talcid researcher stood on its 8 limbs beside Yates on the north side of the scaffold, surrounded by a traction bubble containing its particular mix of atmosphere. Very little oxygen, with a much higher percentage of carbon dioxide, at temperatures low enough to make condensation form on the field's flexible boundaries. Its mossy antlers were in constant motion. All the other non-human researchers were surrounded by similar fields, the most striking being a sinuous, snake-bodied, 4-headed being, suspended in coils in a levitated sphere of deep green liquid, like a preserved specimen. From the evidence, human form beings were not common. Before the gathering, Lanier and the Talcid had engaged in a strange conversation, strange in its clarity and uncanny familiarity, as if they had been no stranger to each other than new neighbors at a block party. The Talsit had stood on the north side of the scaffolding, conversing with a friend, while the second friend waited silently nearby. The friends had homogenized several hours before. There was little need for the second friend to contribute to the conversation, unless parallel thinking was required. Lanier and Patricia had eaten as much from a bountiful floating lunch table as they cared to. Patricia had then gone off with Olme to resume her conversation with Kozhinovsky. Lanier found himself speaking with the Talsit almost by default. The Talsit had approached Preetchen Oyu to discuss her father's plans for the ceremony's aftermath. Their conversation had been Pictet at first, and then she had shifted to English, introducing the Talsit to Lanier. The Talsit spoke perfect English, though nothing moved anywhere on its body in any way to show sound production. Lanier didn't even bother to be curious. He had had a surfeit of marvels, minor and major. It took his full attention just finding the right words to explain how they had come to be here. In conversation with a being not even remotely human in shape and of unknown psychological character, if it could speak perfect English, surely it could also provide a screen for its real thought processes. He talked casually enough about the death, about alternate universes and invasions in space. The Talsit, in turn, discussed its own kind. Lanier found himself nodding in understanding to a story that would have been incomprehensible to him only a few short months ago. The beings called Talsit were offshoots of a unified biological-mechanical intelligence that had once occupied the 14 planets of a very old solar system. At one point, the intelligence had been entirely stored in memory banks, with no physically manifested individuals, not unlike the Axis City memory. But gradually the intelligence had broken down into individuals, a condensation of consciousness within the system, and the individuals had created new forms for their physical manifestation. These had been the parent species of the Talsit. The parent species, this Talsit seemed to imply, still existed, but were introverted and isolationist. They had created the Talsit to act as mercantile representatives, consultants to younger civilizations. A circuit of gates happened to open onto one of their worlds, and they had begun trading, first with the Jarts who had opened the gates, and then with humans, after the Jarts had been pushed back. By implication, the Talsit in their ancestral forms were at least 100 times older than humanity. "Then why even bother communicating with us?" Lanier asked. "Consider it a hobby of one's old age, or senility," the Talsit said without a hint of condescension or dissembling. "My kind have services, particularly regarding the cleansing and reordering of information, which humans and others find invaluable. It pleases us to be useful, and in turn we acquire information of great value to us." The call to the ceremony came a few minutes later, one of the friends ringing a high-pitched, sweet-sounding bell hung from a bar on the south side of the scaffold. Lanier stood at parade rest, hands behind his back, next to Kozhinovsky's image and Preetchen Oyu, while Patricia took a position of honor between Yates and Rai Oyu. Rai Oyu's ceremonial clothes were simple, consisting of rough white cloth shirt and black pants. He wore black cloth slippers. Yates wore a forest green robe, showing some signs of wear. Rai Oyu stepped to the stairs that curved over the top of the rounded scaffold. He stood for a moment, head bowed, and then beckoned for Patricia to follow. "You must learn this," Rai Oyu said to Patricia at the top of the scaffold. "The clavicle can tell you where a gate is to be opened, but only in part. You must also sense the point and tune it to that desired world. There is as much of what you would call intuition as calculation." He bent down and gripped the handles of the clavicle, removing it from its holder at the center of the radiance of traction lines. Patricia stared down and became dizzy. The top of the scaffold was at least 60 meters from the pit bottom. "And there is also ritual. It tunes the mind," the gate opener said. "It prepares. It may not be strictly necessary, but I've always found it useful. Now." He held out the clavicle and closed his eyes. "We're not looking for the usual game today. I've been seeking this junction for 50 years at least, and until now it's always eluded me." He opened one eye and gave her a querying half-smile. "You've been wondering why we're still here, opening another gate that we must inevitably close when the Jarts come or the Axis City passes over. Haven't you been wondering?" Patricia nodded. Because whatever our disloyalty to the present Geshel rulers, I remain faithful to the Hexamon. I will serve the Hexamon even if they believe I'm a traitor, as they must if they know the role I've played in the secession. So to redeem myself, I open this gate.
I still don't understand, Patricia said, head cocked to one side, eyes on the clavicle.
Rai Oryu removed one hand and spread his fingers, swinging his arm to indicate a circle. All gates have been tuned to open onto worlds, planets. The way passes an infinity of possible junctions with other worlds, and we must choose from a large subset of that infinity when we tune at each optimum point. You've noticed, perhaps, that our gates are always spaced at distances no less than 400 kilometers. That's because of the rhythm of the geometry stacks. Do you understand that rhythm?
Patricia nodded. Yes.
We do not venture into the stacks themselves. They commingle alternate universes and timelines in a way not useful to us. We work between. He axed the air with the edge of his hand. We work within a range of 10 meters, and within that range there are perhaps a billion vantages. We tune as closely as we can to the location of an object with planetary mass. The clavicle tells us the mass by picting directly to our minds, giving us all the necessary information. Feel this. He took her hand and placed it on the opposite grip of the clavicle. Her mind was flooded with images, information. Now, look at me. She stared at Rai Oryu, and into her head he picked a rapid, steady flow of techniques. It would be much easier if you had an implant, but at least you have the inclination and the motivation to learn. I cannot give you all the skill, but I can help you hone your intuition. He delivered another series of instructions. Hand still on the clavicle, she felt the flows of data merge. I can't help you find your way home, he said, tapping her hand to get her to remove it from the grip. I won't be with you, and neither will Yates or Olme. We all have business to attend to. But if your theory is correct, and I see no reason why it shouldn't be, then you can find the proper gate within the geometry stack. You have sufficient knowledge for the attempt. Now, watch carefully. We do not open onto another world today. We open onto the way itself.
Patricia frowned.
You've seen the curve, Patricia. I'm sure you've calculated the curve of the way.
Yes, she said.
Have you seen where it crosses itself?
No.
It's a very subtle crossing, and the points are far separated. At such distances, the way's character may be very different. The Axis city will eventually reach those sectors in its travels, perhaps in millions of years, much sooner if the Geshels carry out their present plans. When we open the gate at this junction, we will know what the way actually is, what we have created, and perhaps how extensive it is. We redeem ourselves to the Hexamon by pioneering. Now do you understand why we have stayed here?
Patricia nodded.
Rai Oryu turned to the researchers and his colleagues at the base of the scaffold. Is the engineer ready to witness?
I am here.
Can you experience everything clearly?
Yes, I think so.
The gate opener took a deep breath and glanced sidewise at Patricia. Today we are all privileged, he said to her. The clavicle hummed as he stepped down onto the traction field. He beckoned for Patricia to accompany him. She stood on the lines beside him, and the field dimpled downward where they stood, forming a cup around them. They were within a few meters of the floor of the pit when they stopped their descent. Rai Oryu kneeled and replaced the clavicle in its holder. I've narrowed the region down to a few centimeters, he said. Lifting his head, to Patricia's surprise, he began to chant. In the name of Star, furnace of our being, forge of our substance, greatest of all fires, Star, give us light, give us even in darkness the gift of right creation. He adjusted the clavicle and gripped it tightly with both hands, closing his eyes and lifting his face to the heights of the terminal shell. In fate we lay our trust, in the way of life and light, in ultimate destiny's pattern, which we cannot deny, whatever we choose, however freely we choose.
In the name of Numa, breath of our minds, wind of our thoughts, born of flesh or carried in machine, guide our hands, enthuse us, that we may create in truth ourselves, that we may manifest what is within without.
Lanier saw Kozhinovsky's image mouthing the words along with Rai Oryu. Had the engineer written the ceremony the gate opener now used? The clavicle's hum rose in pitch. Patricia clenched her hands together in front of her, realizing that she was making a gesture of prayer. She could not persuade herself to untangle her fingers and put her hands to her sides. And in the name of the Eld, some of whom are with us this occasion, those born of flesh and those resurrected by the gifts of our past creativity, in the name of those who burned that we might find a truer path, who suffered the death that we may live. Both Patricia and Lanier felt tears brim over and spill down their cheeks. I lift this clavicle to worlds without number and bring a new light to the way, opening this gate that all may prosper. Those who guide and are guided, who create and are created, who light the way and bask in the light so given. He brought the clavicle out of its field receptacle and lifted it between his knees. The stream of Picts issuing from the clavicle lit up his face with a fire-like intensity. The humming had passed out of range of hearing. Behold, I open a new world. The bronze surface of the way beneath them seemed to degenerate into a cross-hatching of black and green and red lines. Rai Oryu stood, keeping the clavicle level in his hands. At the edge of the pit, standing as close as they could to the scaffold, the researchers, Yates, Prescient Oryu, Lanier, and the image of Kozhinovsky, stared down into the silent storm of the gate's beginning. The traction cup lifted the gate opener and Patricia a few meters. Patricia became dizzy again, staring into the pregnant, whirling illusion of color and infinite possibility. The illusion parted, an oily black circle forming at the center. Rai Oryu handed the clavicle to Patricia. She took its grips firmly in her hands. Now feel the power of what is happening, he said in English. Learn the sensation of a correct opening. The clavicle was alive in her hands, part of her, connected with her by its constant picting. Rai Oryu's instructions to her had been quite detailed and were now fixed in her head. The power was exhilarating. She felt like laughing as the clavicle broadened the hole in the surface of the way. Overhead, the incomplete cupola that had sheltered Rai Oryu's work area now moved into position on its own, seeking the center of the disturbance. This is a dangerous time, Rai Oryu said to her. If it gets out of control, the cupola encloses us and smooths out the disturbance. If that happens, we are forever lost to the way. We go wherever the aborted gate takes us, and we cannot come back. Do you feel that potential? She did. Her exhilaration changed into a sensation of having something indescribably nasty and unfriendly by the tail. She kept her eyes on the clavicle. That's it, Rai Oryu said. Olmi could not have been more correct. You're more of our time than your own. The cupola's sketchy racing lines shrank into the familiar active bronze coloration they had seen at other gate sites. At the center of the pit, the vortex surrounding the black circle began to rise, and the traction field carried them higher still. Follow me, Yates told Lanier as the researchers moved outward. They regrouped about 50 meters from the scaffold, near the site of the gate opener's work area. The ground around the pit was buckling, breaking up and forming a tumulus over the rising slope of the gate. The scaffold and traction lines remained level. Rai Oryu resumed his grip on the clavicle. 100,000 possibilities here, he murmured. Through the clavicle I can feel them, experience them. I learn about 100,000 worlds now, but I only want one. I listen for it. I know its character. I know the particular tangent it occupies. The clavicle controls its own probing, keeping its position steady. But I direct and find. His expression was exalted, triumphant.
The oily black circle widened and became an intense cerulean blue. Around the circle, the bronze whey material again took on definition, forming a smooth-lipped depression with the blueness at its center. The depression deepened. Patricia could not avoid characterizing the process as space-time healing, growing accustomed to the unnatural intrusion. Around the circumference of the blueness, she received a camera obscura, fish-eye lens view of something long, bright, and flowing, surrounded by massive dark objects. "The gate is opened," Ryoyu said, shoulders slumping. He slipped the clavicle into its receptacle and stretched out his arms. "Now we find out what lies on the other side."
"Do we enter?" Patricia asked.
"No," the gate opener said with a hint of amusement. "We send one of our mechanical friends. It makes its report, and we make our decision without immediately risking our lives." The traction field cup brought them level with the steps at the top of the scaffold. Ryoyu motioned for Patricia to precede him, and they joined the others near the work area. A cubic monitor about half a meter on a side, large for such devices, floated up the new slope and passed through the bars of the scaffold. It slipped quietly into the depression and through the gate. Yates activated a pictor and tuned it to the monitor's signals, relayed by scaffold transponders. To Lanier, Patricia's stature seemed to have increased. She appeared more self-assured, calm. Taking his hand and squeezing it between both of hers, she smiled at him and whispered,
"I can do it. I felt it. I'll be able to follow through."
The monitor image had not yet come into focus. Yates translated pics carrying information about the conditions on the other side. "The monitor is in a high vacuum," he said, "with a very low radiation count. If we are indeed in another section of the way, the flaw is particularly inactive and stable." "There doesn't seem to be any flaw," Ryoyu commented, squinting in concentration. The visual image clarified.
"It's enormous," Senator Oyu said quietly.
At whatever point the gate had intersected the way, the tube-shaped universe had expanded to a diameter of at least 50,000 kilometers.
"Geodesic drift," Patricia said.
"Well, that might account for it," Ryoyu said, "but it may not be inherent." Lanier didn't bother asking for an explanation. He doubted he could absorb it. The way was filled with cyclopean structures, dark crystalline masses thousands of kilometers long, some floating free, casting broad shadows against the opposite walls of the way as they passed before an intense, meandering, snake-like plasma tube. "Surface attraction is about 1/10 G, Yates said. "The parameters are substantially different, Rye. Do you suppose it's another way, not our own?"
"Do we have reason to believe anyone else would have made a universe like this one?" the gate opener asked.
"No," Yates admitted. "We imposed our own heritage on the shape of the way when we made it cylindrical. I strongly doubt others would duplicate it, not with the endless possibilities available. Still, there's a convenience to such a shape. A practicality if commerce is desired." Ryoyu agreed to that much with a curt nod. He seemed angry, surveying the results of his work. "It's very strange there," he said. "No detectable flaw, and the plasma tube is highly irregular. I'd say it's been tampered with."
"By Jarts?"
"No," the gate opener said. "Those structures are very un-Jart-like. I'm not sure I can conceive any practical uses for them. They're either distortions in the geometry, space-time extrusions and crystallizations, or..." He shook his head.
"Or they're beyond our comprehension. And besides, I doubt very much if Jarts could have progressed so far. This junction, if it is a junction, has to be beyond 1x15, over 100 light-years down the way."
"There can't be any gates there, then," Patricia said.
Yates raised his eyebrows. "Why not?"
"Because that's beyond the end of our universe in time. Gates would open onto..."
She held up her hands.
"Nothing. No."
"Not necessarily," Ryoyu said, "but you have an interesting point. The way is adapted to fit conditions in its epoch of origin. Where it surpasses those conditions, extends beyond them, it may naturally reach other accommodations."
Can the Axis city ever travel that far, Prescient Oryu asked.
I don't know. If the flaw ceases to exist, they would have to make adjustments. It would be difficult. And if there's no flaw beyond a certain point...
The way is self-sustaining, Yates finished for him.
It is indeed. It doesn't require sixth-chamber machinery or any connection with the Thistledown.
It looks empty, Lanier said, unsure he should enter into the discussion. I don't see any traffic. There's no movement.
Yates instructed the monitor to survey the region. The images became greatly magnified, revealing the cyclopean crystals in more detail. The way was filled with them, some soaring from one side to the other across tens of thousands of kilometers, the plasma tube curving around them. All of the structures, even those floating free, were covered with cupola-like disks, each protecting the obvious blisters of open gates. The image magnified several more times. Shimmering strands of light passed in thick nets between the densely packed gates. There was traffic, commerce of some sort, but on an inconceivably vast scale and of a different kind than they had ever witnessed. More pics flashed between the images.
Definitely no flaw, Yates affirmed. The way at this point is completely stable and self-consistent.
Patricia appeared half asleep. She was in the state again, Lanier realized. She was struggling to understand what was happening. It was completely beyond him.
It's causally connected, she said thickly.
Pardon? Lanier asked, glancing at the others and cupping her elbow in his hand. She opened her eyes wide and stared at him.
If the Axis city travels at near light speed down the way, this is what will happen, even before the journey begins. The way lies essentially outside time and has to accommodate any event within its length. This is what will happen, especially if the Thistledown end is sealed off.
Yes, please continue, Yates urged.
She's right, Kozhinovsky said. It's perfectly obvious. And you have somebody, not humans, not Jarks, not even of our universe, taking advantage of the adaptation.
Ryoryu smiled broadly.
I'm afraid it isn't obvious to us. Please go on.
Patricia looked at the engineer and felt a stir of recognition.
Herself. Something about herself. Kozhinovsky nodded to her.
You're doing fine, he said.
We're looking at the results carried along superspace vectors of what is about to happen in the way, she said. I was thinking about this before we left for Timbal. After the rogue came to my quarters. If the Axis city travels faster than one-third light speed, it will twist the way and create a space-time shockwave that will exceed light speed, moving ahead of it. The shockwave will operate outside of time, arriving before its cause. The shockwave has already passed this point, perhaps centuries ago, perhaps even before the way was opened. Something traveling at near light speed on the singularity, the flaw, will strain it beyond its endurance. It will convert virtual particles into energy, radiate, evaporate.
She took a deep breath and closed her eyes, seeing the mathematics being done even as she spoke.
The way has been forced to expand to a stable configuration. The flaw has vanished.
Olmi said nothing, calmly listening to Kozhinovsky and Patricia.
He's proud, Lanier thought.
For several light years until the way expands and the city's shockwave dissipates, everything will be sterilized ahead of the city. Nothing will exist in these segments but the city. All features will be wiped out, all gates fused shut.
She pointed to the structures. Obviously, the way has expanded here, and relativistic objects along its length won't bother it quite as much.
Lanier tried to puzzle out the flaws vanishing even before the construction of the object that would force its evaporation. He quickly lost himself in contradictions, but the contradictions didn't seem to bother Kozhinovsky or the gate openers.
When we've prepared the documentation...
You can do that, can't you, soon, he asked Patricia.
She agreed.
With Sir Kozhinovsky's help.
Then we will know most of what we need to know, Ryoryu said. We can present our report to the president. His faction can do with it what they please.
He smiled.
What apparently they must.
Bright red ticks appeared before the defense monitor, signaling an urgent message. Olmi went to receive them. When he returned, his expression was jubilant, paradoxically so, considering what he said next. The Jarts have opened their gate. It's a remote at about 1.5x9. They've cut off the last defense station. There's a plug of plasma reaching top velocity. It's about 7 hours from us. We have to leave, now.
Prescient Oyu looked to her father.
The Geshels will refuse to let the Jarts push them out, she said.
Then the president has no choice now, does he, Rai Oyu said. The way writes his destiny, and so do the Jarts. He must take his precincts, and we must take ours and follow our separate paths.
Chapter 63. Mirska and the three other defectors had been given small spherical quarters in the central city walled. Three Geshel homorphs, two females and one of uncertain sex, had been assigned to host them and guide their short-term education and accustomization. Mirska sat within his sphere, tuned to various channels of Pictet information, some translated for them by pedagogue partials of their hosts. He and Rajensky had accepted temporary implants to help speed tutoring and interpretation. They watched and listened and said little. Rajensky stayed close to him, while Rimskaya, the American with the feminine name, kept aloof. The others he paid little attention to. They were very small ciphers in a huge mystery. The hosts came to them, incarnate to minimize alarm, and taught brief high-density classes while their guests absorbed as much as they could. The sense of urgency was thick in the air. Except for their hosts, the Geshels paid little attention to the defectors. The wall was almost deserted, most of its occupants taking new work positions to ready the precincts for whatever might come. The reports from the farthest-flung defense stations had reached the now-divided Axis city. The Jarts had opened a remote gate and allowed the deep interior plasma of a star to enter the way. It would take about 70 hours for the destruction to reach the end of the way, but the occupants of the Geshel precincts of the Axis city had to decide their course of action quickly. If they wished to remain in the way and not give it over to the Jarts, they had to have their precincts up to at least one-third light speed before encountering the plasma front. With the entry of the star's material into the way, the plasma temperature would drop considerably below the level required for fusing, but would still remain in the neighborhood of 900,000 degrees. The passage of the Geshel precincts would change that, however. When they actually hit the front, their space-time shockwave would smash the superhot plasma into a thin film. The film, lining the way after their passage, heated to temperatures far beyond those necessary for fusion, would then fill the way with an even more powerful plasma. In effect, the precincts would convert the plasma and the way into a tube-shaped nova. Mirsky, trying to keep track of the public discussions, thought their plans were deliriously, deliciously insane. Whether he died or not seemed minor. He was in the middle of a grand scheme, far more ostentatious than anything he could ever have imagined. The Geshel politicians, given their freedom by the secessionists, made frantic plans. There had to be sufficient shielding, front and rear, to prevent the precincts being flooded with hard radiation. That would place a heavy strain on the four main floor generators left to them, which would be burden enough with having to contact the floor at such high velocities. Could it be done? Yes, the physicists decided, but just barely. There would also have to be shielding along the floor passage. The floor itself would be emitting very high levels of lethal radiation. Could all the required shielding be maintained? Yes, but with even stronger reservations. Despite the doubts, there was a surprising consensus among the precinct's occupants. They did not wish to return to Earth. They looked to the future, not the past. And, having fought Jarts for centuries, they were not about to give up the way to them now. Rimskaya, drifting through the woods outside his sphere, avoided hearing all the details. He prayed devoutly, not caring who saw him or what their reaction was. His principal worry was, could God hear prayers spoken outside of normal space-time? Would there come a moment when they were completely cut off from God? His assigned host, a female homorph, kept her distance at his request, realizing there was little she could do to assure him. For her, his questions fell into an extinct classification of knowledge, as meaningless as how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. Waiting for the news of the final plans to reach them, Rogensky and Mirsky floated a few meters from each other in the greenery. A macrame pattern of light snakes brightened a deep three-dimensional glade beyond their quarters, casting leaf shadows over them. Mirsky studied the young corporal carefully, noting the shine of his skin, the loose excitement around his lips, the way his eyes started from his face. The future is a drug for him, Mirsky thought. Was it that way for himself as well? I understand so little, Rogensky confided, pulling himself along a branch closer to Mirsky's position in a crook. But I feel I will understand, and they are so helpful. We are strange to them, don't you feel that? But they welcome us.
We are novelties, Mirsky said. He did not want to exhibit his own misgivings to the corporal. His own heart beat faster each time he thought of what they faced. The female Humoff, assigned to the morose American, tracted toward them.
Your friend worries me, she said. We're considering returning him to your people. He won't admit it, but I think he's made the wrong decision.
Give him time, Mirsky said. We've all left a lot behind. We'll be very homesick. I'll talk to him.
I will too, Rogensky said enthusiastically.
No, Mirsky said, holding up his hand. Just me. We talked when I negotiated with the Americans, and we volunteered together. Rogensky, abashed, agreed with a sharp nod. Mirsky knocked on the pearl-colored, translucent outer surface of the sphere. Within, Rimskaya answered.
Yes, what, in English?
Pavel Mirsky. No more talking, please. We don't have much time. Either you go back now, or you face up to our decision. Leave me alone.
May I come in?
The sphere's door dilated, and Mirsky pulled himself inside.
They'll be leaving soon, he said. There won't be any choice after they get started. You'll be here forever.
Rimskaya looked terrible. Pale, his red hair sticking out in all directions, his face scruffy with a 4 days' growth of beard. I'm staying, he said. I've made up my mind.
That's what I told your hostess.
You're speaking for me?
No.
What does it matter to you? You're back from the dead. You don't give a damn about your position. Your own people tried to kill you. Me, I've left responsibilities, loyalties.
Why?
Mirsky asked. Shit, I don't know.
Maybe I do.
Rimskaya regarded him doubtfully.
You want to see the ultimate, Mirsky said.
Rimskaya simply stared, neither confirming nor denying.
You, me, Rogensky, maybe even the woman, we're misfits. We aren't happy with just living one life. We reach out.
He held up a grasping hand.
I always wanted to see the stars.
You wanted to see stars, so you went into space to fight a war, Rimskaya said. We don't know what we'll see. More of this godforsaken corridor. He wrapped his face in his hands. All my life I've been a hardliner. Everyone thought I was a passionless old asshole. Math and sociology and university. My life held within four walls. When I was sent to the stone, God, what an experience. And then this opportunity.
We know it will be interesting, far beyond what we could find on Earth.
The others are going back to save Earth, Rimskaya said, fists curled tight against his sides.
That makes us irresponsible?
Perhaps, but no more so than all the people in this half of the city. Rimskaya shrugged. Look, I've made my decision, and I'm sticking with it. Don't worry about me. I'll be fine.
That's all I wanted to hear, Mirsky said.
Are you wearing the implant they gave you? Rimskaya asked. Mirsky pulled his right ear forward and turned his head to show he was. I still have mine, Rimskaya said. He opened one fist to reveal the peanut-sized device.
You'll need it, Mirsky said.
He lingered a moment longer, and the American slowly raised the implant to his head and positioned it behind his ear. Chapter 64
We leave each other now, Ryoyu told his daughter and Yates.
He held out his hand, and the senator grasped it between hers. Olmi, Patricia, Lanier, and Kozhinovsky waited for them beside the disk.
"What's he planning?" Patricia asked.
"He's going through the gate," Olmi said. "The Talcet will accompany him. One of the France as well. All the rest are coming with us."
"He can't survive," Lanier said. "They can't possibly take enough food, oxygen. There isn't time to prepare."
"He's not going incarnate," Olmi explained. "None of them are. They'll transfer personality to a long-term gate worker. They can research as much as they wish, open other gates, wait for the Axis city if it reaches that distance. They have millions of years of energy."
Krishan Oyu shook her head slowly, watching her father's face.
"You've done well with me," she said. "It won't be easy, not being able to speak with you, ever."
"Come with the Geshul precincts," Rai Oyu said. "We might meet again, far down the way. Who knows what their plans will be, if they succeed. And besides, somebody can always reopen this gate, find us again."
"No one will ever find this gate again," she countered. "Only you could find it and open it."
"She's right," Yates said. "It was your skill."
Rai Oyu nodded in Patricia's direction.
"Kozhinovsky, or the Earthwoman, they could. But then Kozhinovsky's returning to Earth, and she goes hunting for something even more elusive. Well, at any rate, nothing is final."
"This is," Prishan Oryu said. "I'm going back to Earth. It's what we've been working for."
She let go of his hand.
The gate opener picked at a symbol to her. Earth, blue and green and brown, clouds vivid and alive, and surrounding it, a loop of DNA. And around that, the simplified equation that Kozhinovsky had taken from one of the Elder Vasquez's papers. The Talcet in its cold bubble, and a Frant in a white coat of permanent parting, unpacked just moments before, stood behind Rai Oyu. Krishan Oyu reached across and kissed him, then turned to join the rest of the disk. The gate opener and his companions moved toward the workshop and the tumulus around the new gate.
"He fulfills his pledge to the Hexamon," Prishan Oyu said as the disk closed around them. "He'll guide the Axis city if it comes his way."
She reached out to Patricia, whose eyes were again moist, and touched the Earthwoman's cheek. Removing a tear, Prishan Oyu placed it on her own cheek. Olmi instructed the disk to take them out of the terminal and up to the waiting floor ships. Both of the floor ships, the gate opener's staff vessel and the defense craft they had arrived in, had removed themselves from the floor and hung tethered by traction fields, a precaution in case evacuating defense ships came from the north. Olmi chose quickly. They needed speed, and the smaller defense craft was the faster. They had to meet the accelerating precincts before they had reached one-third light speed. There were two options then. The precincts could briefly pull in their generators and floor grips and allow the defense floor ship to move through the passage, or the defense ship would have to disengage, hug the wall, and weather the pressure wave of particles and atoms pushed before the city. But before they encountered the precincts, he had to fulfill his promise to Patricia. In the barren sectors where she was likely to find the geometry stacks she needed, she would be sent with a clavicle to the surface of the way. She would have very little time to accomplish her work. The plasma front would be right behind them. Yates took Patricia to an isolated section of the ship and gave her final instructions on the use of the clavicle. "Remember," he told her when he was finished, "you have the instinct and the desire, but not much skill. You have the knowledge, but not the experience. You must not be rash. You must be deliberate and careful." He took her by the shoulders and faced her directly. "Do you know your chances of success?" She nodded. "Not very good."
"And you'll still take the risk?"
She nodded again without hesitation.
Yates let her go and produced the small box from his pocket. "When I press the clavicle into your hands and transfer its services to you, it will grow to its active size. It will work for you only. If you die, it will crumble to dust. So long as you live, it will serve you. Though what use it will be if you succeed, I don't know. It will open new gates only from within the way, not from without. It will recognize the existence of prior gates,
even should they be closed. Yates removed the clavicle, now little more than 12 centimeters long, and pressed it into her left hand. "Take both grips," he instructed. She held both between the thumb and forefinger of each hand. The clavicle picked at a steady stream of red symbols at Yates. "It doesn't recognize you now," he said. "It's asking for instructions from its last master. I will reactivate it." He instructed the clavicle in Pictid code. The device slowly enlarged in Patricia's hands until it was the same size as the clavicle used by Rai Oyu. "Now I pass its control to you." More instructions in code, and Patricia felt a sudden warmth between herself and the device. Kozhinovsky watched from a few meters back. Lanier floated behind him near the floor passage.
"I can talk with it now," Patricia said in wonder. "I can tell it things directly."
"And it can communicate with you. It is active, and you are its master," Yates said. There was a touch of sadness in his voice. Kozhinovsky came forward. "I have some thoughts on your search, suggestions for technique," he said.
"I'd love to hear them," Patricia said.
At a steady acceleration of 20 G's, the floor ship moved south along the way. The plasma front reached the 60-kilometer sector reserved for the last gate opening, slamming against the barriers, the extreme heat upsetting their subtle geometry. Down came the first barrier, and the little oasis was incinerated. The circuit of wells was fused shut, and the surface of the way became smooth and undisturbed. Final messages from gates along the human-controlled length of the way told of evacuations. Millions of humans decided to remain on the worlds beyond their assigned gates, rather than choose between the separated sections of the Axis city. The last remnants of way commerce were shut down, and the gates were sealed, preparing both for the passage of the Geshel precincts and the arrival of the plasma front. Despite the nearness of the plasma front, Olney began decelerating. The floor ship had two blunt arrowhead flyers. Prescient Oyu was outfitting one for Patricia's journey. Patricia went to Lanier and hugged him strongly.
"I appreciate all you've done for me," she said.
Lanier wanted to convince her not to make the attempt, but he didn't try. "You've come to mean a great deal to me," he said.
"Not just a green kid you have to look after?"
she asked, smiling. "Much more than that.
I..."
He looked away from her, face working through a variety of discomforts, and then shook his head. "You're something, Patricia." He laughed sharply then, through tears.
"I'm not sure what, but you're really something." "Would you like to go with her?" Olney asked, tracting aft. In each hand he held a small black spherical monitor.
"What?" Lanier asked.
"She'll need help. I'm going."
Prescient Oyu saw Lanier's confusion and explained.
"You'll create a partial. The monitor will project the partial. It won't be able to report back to you, of course, since we must move on as soon as we release Patricia."
"The partials will die?" Lanier asked.
"They will be destroyed along with the monitors," Olney said. "But we won't."
Lanier felt an eerie wind through his head. "Yes," he said. "I'd like that very much." Ramon, reading Tiempos de los Ángeles. Rita, fixing a meal for the homecoming.
Coming home. Paul, waiting. What will I tell Paul? You wouldn't believe. Or, I've been unfaithful, Paul, but...
Or just smile at him and start over again. Olney and Lanier, rather their partials, sat beside Patricia in the flyer. She carried the clavicle in her lap. The screen before her showed the barren, smooth surface of the way. She held the clavicle grips tightly, feeling the quality of the superspace at each point beneath the surface, transmitted through the clavicle. What she was looking for was far more difficult to find than a particular grain of sand on a beach. She was searching for a universe without the death, and without herself also, where the stone had arrived but not caused war, and where her alternate had somehow died. Not finding that, and she was far from sure she could be that precise, though such a place would exist,
and would be distinct from all the others. She would settle for a universe where there would be two of her. She would settle for anything that would take her home. She glanced at Lanier's image. He smiled at her, encouraging and uncertain at once. And suddenly, without any reason, without any certainty of her success, she felt wonderful. Patricia Luisa Vasquez existed in a bubble of joy, independent of all that had gone before, not caring what would come after. She had never experienced anything like it. It had neither confidence nor euphoria in its character. It simply was an appreciation of all she had experienced and would experience, a fulfillment of the compulsion she had had since childhood not to be normal, not to live a normal existence, but to subject herself to the most extraordinary experiences she could possibly have. The world being what it was, she had long since decided she would have to create those extraordinary conditions in her head. And then the world turned upon itself. The universes had twisted in some incomprehensible fashion and delivered to her an experience drawn from the visions in her head, made even more wonderfully strange and outré by history, by the actions of tens of billions of people, and who could tell how many non-humans. Her moment was not solipsistic. She did not feel in the least isolated or unique, but she realized how extraordinary her life was. She had already fulfilled her wildest and most deeply held dreams. Anything else is gravy, she thought, even going home. The flyer landed smoothly on the surface of the way. In her hands, the clavicle emitted a pleasant, busy hum, telling her that they would have to be several kilometers south. She informed Olmi's partial, and he lifted the flyer up for another short hop. Overhead, the flaw ship accelerated south again. She closed her eyes, letting the clavicle's sensations stream through her. She seemed to see a kind of digest of every cluster of alternate universes, tasting them, being part of them, but she could not grasp them. She could not do anything more with the sensations than guide the clavicle. No detailed knowledge about the other realms was conveyed, only the fact of their existence, and whether or not they fell within the range she was seeking. The partials would not need a protective field, but she would. Olmi prepared a traction bubble and environment for her. Lanier stayed beside her. How much of him is here, she wondered. What is it like when a partial is destroyed? Then she turned her full attention to the clavicle. The nose hatch opened, and Patricia stepped out onto the surface of the way, surrounded by the flexible, faintly glowing traction bubble. Lanier and Olmi followed, walking beside her without aid in the high vacuum. End of Side 11.